this week on the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast.
I believe that the best way to learn writing is to actually sit down and write. You're going to learn from your mistakes.
Welcome to the Red Sneaker Writers Podcast. News, interviews, and writing tips for people who are serious about having a writing career and want some practical knowledge to help them achieve it. Your host is the nationally best-selling author of more than 50 books, William Bernhardt.
Hello, sneakers. We are streaming live from WriterCon. As you may have guessed, we've got a live audience watching this live stream. We're on the second day of WriterCon, and we are having a great time. Every session, every speaker, every attendee, this is such a wonderful community of writers of the best world. Writers are my heroes, and this weekend has just made me appreciate them all so much more. This has been a great writers' conference. And I want to talk to some of the people who are attending this year. But first, Jesse, my co-host and sound engineer, this is your first WriterCon. What do you think?
Oh, it's been great. Yeah. I definitely like having both my presentation and this live podcast on the same day. It's very good for my nerves and my stomach.
You're here. We want to get, the most that we can out of make the most. All right. My interview guest today is our keynote speaker at WriterCon and the fabulous award-winning author David Farland, sitting right to my right here. He's a fantasy author and a renowned advisor, writing coach, author of Million Dollar Outlines and several other wonderful books on writing. We're going to talk to him more later. We're going to talk to the people here at WriterCon, but first, the news. Okay, we're going to have an abridged news section because I want to hear from other people. But two things I wanted to point out. Item number one, book sales are soaring. People here at WriterCon have heard me saying this for 2 days now, but it is absolutely true. Penguin Random House just posted the best profits they have seen in 19 years. And that seems to be true all across the board for most large traditional publishers. Their profits are up by 55%, but it's not just them. Barnes & Noble also just posted a sales increase of about 5 to 6% over 2019, which is also incredible. Even independent publishers are doing well. And Jesse is showing you a graphic from an article in Publishers Weekly that talked to people at Beacon Press and Chelsea Green and Turner. It's the same story for every one of them. Book sales are up. That's why I'm telling you this is the best time to be a writer. Keep writing, Red Sneaker Writers. Okay, Amazon two, item two, because it wouldn't seem right if we didn't have something about Amazon, right? Amazon is making a big move into audio. They're moving to podcasts, presumably for the advertising dollars. As you may have heard, they just acquired the big podcast network, Wondery, as well as the distribution rights to SmartLess. They are believed to be investing big time into live audio. Right now, the focus is on live music and events. Maybe they're going to use this on Alexa or some other way, but podcasts clearly are going to enter the mix. Why else would they have bought that? Why does it matter? Well, Amazon typically does not do things unless they've got a good reason. And they're making moves into podcasting and music subscriptions. Clearly, they see audio as a way of bolstering the other types of content it offers through their Alexa home devices or from the Amazon Prime Video service. All of these things exploded during the pandemic, and they're seeing big investments from Silicon Valley, and now Amazon is getting into the game. I don't know, Jesse, is Amazon going to push all the sound engineers out of the market? What do you think?
I mean, luckily, Amazon has not shown the best ability of pulling all these things together into things people understand. Just like how you where do I go for Amazon podcasts exactly? Even Amazon doesn't know.
Right.
They're on Audible, they're on Amazon Music. So until they figure out the sort of Google messaging problem, which is choosing one app and sticking with that app, I'm okay.
So they're going to rename Wondery Alexa or something?
Yeah, Alexa think? Podcast or something. Eventually, they'll hire a consultant who they'll pay million of dollars, and that consultant will tell them, make it one app. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, why didn't we do that?
So I mean, clearly, they want to take over audio and podcasts the way they have the book market, pretty much. Think that's going to happen?
No, because like the spirit of podcast is not corporate that way. So right. There will always be, you know, as I mentioned in my podcasting talk, guerrilla media out there. So
I hope you're right. All right. Like I promised, I want to turn the mic over to some of the people here at WriterCon so you can hear from them what they're getting out of this conference, what they've learned, and why they're here. I got a couple of people to talk to you. The first is Grady Weiserick. Grady, I'm sure I at least approximately got your last name pronounced right. Take the microphone. Tell us your WriterCon experience.
Perfect. Well, I'm here from Minnesota, and this year WriterCon is obviously in Oklahoma. And something that has stood out to me while I've been here is I've not only talked to great fellowship and had a great fellowship with people here in Oklahoma, mm-hmm. but I've talked with people from New York, people from California. And what's really stood out to me is the investment that people have seen from all across the nation in WriterCon and the value in coming here. You know, getting the chance to hear from David Barland.
I mean, that's holy fantastic. Smokes. Yeah.
And I'm not only learning how to develop my plots further, develop my characters further, but in addition, I'm getting an understanding of the publishing industry as a whole. There's so much pessimism out there with COVID-19 currently of everyone saying things are backed up and such on and so forth on that topic. But hearing from you is really insightful because I'm getting that optimistic appearance back when it comes to my manuscript of saying, hey, things are moving in some areas of the world, so let's get rolling.
Exactly. That is so good to hear. Man, it is so true. We got people at this conference from all over the country, not just speakers, but guests. And we've got people streaming. I'm not making this up. We got streamers from Iceland. We got a couple of people in New Zealand. I guess podcasts go everywhere, at least until Amazon owns the whole thing, right? And that seems to be bringing a lot of people to... There it was again. And that's bringing a lot of people to WriterCon. One of our guests here at WriterCon is Jessica Smith. Both Grady and Jessica won some of the awards at the contest today, but I know you don't want me to embarrass you by talking about that. So anyway, tell us about your WriterCon experience.
No, so this is my first writers conference, and it has been such a huge blessing. The friendships formed, the connections getting to be made, and learning both on the side of creative writing and on the business side of writing has already been so awesome. And one of the classes that I just got finished with is character development mm-hmm. from an actress's point of view. And as an actress myself, mm-hmm. I really resonated with that and being able to take the performance side of things and, you know, kind of being a kinesthetic learner and being able to incorporate that in the way I write my characters right. and the depth that comes from that. Mm-hmm. And so I am a Christian fantasy author and also a women's Bible study devotional author. It currently on the journey to becoming published. And so any scraps and pieces that I can learn while here, it's been great. And I love to be able to incorporate that when I get home and get to work.
Fabulous. Thanks for sharing, Jessica. You know, what I really love is you kind of talked about the art and craft of writing, which, of course, many of our sessions are discussing. Grady talked a little bit more about the journey toward getting published and getting agents and marketing and figuring out what you're going to do next. Okay, I've got a book, now what? And, of course, we cover it all at WriterCon. Four sessions going on at every time period over 3 days, and then bonus classes on Monday. So I didn't actually plan it. Everybody will think that I will, but it's wonderful the way that it worked out. Thanks so much for sharing. I want to talk now to our very special guest, our keynote speaker, the incredibly New York Times best-selling author who has not only written fantastic books himself, The Room Lords, and so much more, plus books on writing, Plus, he has been a genuine and instrumental factor in the careers, the writing careers of a lot of people you've heard of before, because they're major league best-selling authors. David, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
Thank you so much for being here. All right. We have a traditional first question here on the Red Sneaker Writers podcast. If you could give them one piece of advice, what would it be?
I believe that the best way to learn writing is to actually sit down and write. You're going to learn from your mistakes, all of the new tricks that you're trying to learn. So you basically are really practicing what you are studying.
Mm-hmm. How do you have time to do as much as you do? I mean, you're doing your own writing. I know you're mentoring a lot of people on writing on a regular basis. You've written these books on writing as well as you're selling novels. I mean, how do you make all that happen?
Methamphetamines. No. Seriously, I've always just been a workaholic, and I love what I do. You know, saying that if you love it, you'll never work a day in your life. So it's I try to avoid work as much as I possibly can for 18 hours a day.
Okay, let's break this down piece at a time. I know a lot of people listening will be interested in success stories. So let's first talk about the teaching and coaching, and then we're going to talk about your own books, all right? You have worked with Brandon Sanderson, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've worked with Stephanie Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
You were an instrumental, one thing at a time. We'll get to Harry Potter in a minute, but mm-hmm. How did all this happen? How did you get in touch with all these fantastic authors?
You know, sometimes I just feel like it was luck, you know? I mean, you
start— They're luck, I think, but go ahead.
You start teaching, and one of your students takes off, and other ones take off, and all of a sudden I looked at it, and I had, a dozen people who are number one New York Times bestsellers and who were my students, plus over 100 others who are New York Times bestsellers who didn't hit number one, along with others that, you know, aren't on the list, but are still doing quite well. And it's just sort of, I've just been doing this for years, and I just seem to get in contact with people with a lot of talent and hard work ethic.
Yeah. Give me a ballpark. How many people would you say you've worked with who are now successfully published authors?
Well, early in my career, back in the 1990s, I reached a point where I was working as a lead judge for one of the world's largest writing contests.
You're talking about Writers of the Future?
Yes. And I used to send out critiques to people. And I realized one day that I had over 100 people who had written me feedback who said, I followed your critique and it worked just great. I sold my first short story. And when I got to about 300 or 400 of those back in 1995, I quit counting. So I've probably just hundreds. I don't even know. Mm-hmm. I can't even tell. People who email me, I had a fellow from Africa who emailed me a while back and said, you know, I've always wanted to be a writer. I started following your writing tips. He says, I've never had a writing class. I just wanted to thank you. I just sold my first book for $400,000. And I'm just like, okay, that's great to hear.
Where's your cut?
But honestly, right. I can't remember his name. So, but you get that kind of thing where there's just a lot of people that you often you have no idea, because when you do this podcast, you don't know who all you're talking to, you know, and that's the same way I've been for many years.
Oh, man. So I think you said during the keynote that Brandon Sanderson was one of your first students mm-hmm. when you were at Brigham Young, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had been working with Writers of the Future, so I had a number of students who've gone on and done quite well from there. But Brandon was in my very first writing class at Writers at Brigham Young University. We had Dan Wells, who came in the next semester, and then Stephanie Meyer the semester after that. And
they must have been kind of sorry when you decided to leave.
Well, yeah, I went to Hollywood, but we had Brandon take over my writing class. So,
oh, really?
So they've been doing quite well.
Oh, fantastic.
Me.
Is he still teaching then?
Yes, he is.
Oh, that's wonderful. Okay. Tell us the Stephanie Meyer story, because I think this, will put any doubters to rest, because you really helped steer her in the right direction.
Yeah. Stephanie was an excellent writer. And I remember looking at one of her early stories and thinking, this girl has a really great talent for character voice. And I thought, you know, she could even be dangerous if she got an idea that she loved. And she asked one day, she asked me after class, how do you write the best-selling young adult novel of all time? And she was a very passionate and intelligent person.
Ambitious, I'd say.
And ambitious, yeah. Okay. And my first thought was, are you sure you really want that? Because you're going to get fans out, you know, driving you crazy. But we sat down and I said, well, okay. I was studying audience analysis. And I said, here's a way to do it. I said, if you write a book with a female young adult protagonist who is the age of 16, who goes to a new town and meets someone there who has magical powers or some other special powers, so that he is at once both who arouses a sense of wonder and romance. If you can mix those two, you're mm-hmm. going to have a very potent combination for a 16-year-old girls. And I said, that's the key to writing that book. And of course, now in New York, everybody's trying to do that, but they don't understand what it is that they're actually trying to hit. Right. Stephanie blended romance, wonder, and adventure pretty much perfectly in her books.
What kind of mixing genres, am I right? Which mm-hmm. is only going to expand the audience.
Exactly. The more genres that you can blend in, the more you'll expand your audience.
I mean, when you normally hear people talk about vampires, they're thinking about a Hungarian guy and not very really good-looking, hunky teenagers who sparkle when they go outside, right?
That's right.
But Twilight turned out, despite having vampires, to be really not so much horror as romance and adventure, which is so there's a little bit that's unexpected and a lot to expand the audience.
Precisely, yeah. And Stephanie did a brilliant job with that.
Mm-hmm.
And we took a basic concept and she just ran with it and did a great job.
That's really impressive. All right. In another one of your careers, I know you also played a role in the American distribution of, what's that series with the kid and he's got the thing on his, Harry Potter, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Well, tell us your Harry Potter story.
Well, I was writing some books for Scholastic at the time. I was working on some Star Wars books for them. And I turned in my first little Star Wars book and my editor, David Levithan, said, you know, the president of the company absolutely loved this. She thought it was the best thing we'd done in 32 years. And so she asked if you might be willing to look at some books and help us find one to push big for next year. And so I looked at about 40 books that they had done, and I basically said, push Harry Potter. Okay. And we sat down and we talked about it for a good 2 hours, talking about why I thought it would be a bestseller. And, and part of it had to do with that large audience. Okay. Because it was a book that would appeal to kids and to grandparents and right. just as well. And then we also talked about, you know, she said, well, how would you distribute this book? And I said, well, you want to distribute this book over the holidays, because about 70% of the books bought for middle grade kids are bought by grandparents and parents over the Christmas breaks. So you want to rent out space at the major bookstore chains in the front windows and behind the counter so that you can't go into the store without seeing the book ad, and then put a big pile of them right in the middle of the store. And that was going to require a huge investment, but they did it. And, and Rowling went ahead and wrote two more books in between the time that book came out, came out, and all of a sudden we were promoting three books instead of one. And
first three books
in the series, and it just exploded. Yeah.
Wow, that must have been exciting to see that. I mean, exploded isn't even a good enough word to explain what happened in the Potterverse.
It became the best selling book of all time in the English language. Pretty rapidly, because the previous record holder was A Tale of Two Cities, which had been out for 150 years. And now they're at 500 million sales, which, you know, is just astronomical.
Wow. Well, let's talk a little bit about what you're doing today. And I promise we'll get to your books too. But I know you're doing a lot of mentoring of people, some of it online for obvious reasons because of COVID and whatnot. Talk about that a little bit, would you please?
Well, yeah, I've been doing online teaching now for, eight or nine years. And with COVID, it just kind of exploded. You know, all of a sudden people couldn't go to conventions. And so they started taking my classes. I've got several things that I do. I'm teaching a class. I decided last year it would be fun to do my 318R class from Brigham Young University and just do it again. This is the class that Stephanie Meyer and Brandon Sanderson took. So I've been teaching that. And I've been teaching just a lot of things. I wanted to start a writing group. I had a writer who was a shepherd back in New Zealand and couldn't get to a writing group. And I said, you know, there's got to be a way for us to hook up online. And, you know, you look back at, you know, Ernest Hemingway and Faulkner were in the same writing group through the mail. And then you look at people like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien are in the same writing group. So when you've got great writers working together, it just really helps everyone blossom. So I started a big online writing group. Mm-hmm. I have about 450, 500 people who are in the writing group now, and they're loving it. So
that's fantastic. So just in case there's somebody who's interested in taking the same class that Stephanie Meyer took, mm-hmm. how do people find out about this?
Well, you can go to my site at mystorydoctor.com. Mm-hmm. Okay. And that will give you links to just about everything. You can run it down from there because it'll tell you about what classes are coming up. And you can sign up for my newsletter, that free newsletter that guy talked about that he'd read and sold his novel for $400,000. Well, that's up there for free. And I've got a free writing book on it. If you do that, I saved 100 of my favorite blogs that I've done over the past 15 years and put them on there. And so, just a fun way for people to get some free advice. And if they want, they can sign up for a class or something.
Wow. That's great. Now you've written several books on writing as well, mm-hmm. including the one I mentioned before, mm-hmm. Million Dollar Outlines, mm-hmm. Million Dollar. That's a pretty good hook for a book title.
Yeah, you know? Well,
I could see that having appeal.
I really wanted to write a book about how to outline, but I wanted to distinguish it from other books on outlining because I wanted people who are interested in writing bestsellers to understand how to appeal to a wide audience. And so Million Dollar Outlines is as much about audience analysis as it is on outlining.
So how's that work? I mean, you're giving people outlines for their books or is it fill in the blank?
It's fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. I think that a book comes together when you learn to ask the right questions. Right. And so, you know, who's your protagonist going to be and how many protagonists are you going to have? What genres are you going to blend? What emotional draws are the most important for this particular audience? And we start asking those questions. And as you fill in the answers, mm-hmm. your idea for a book will come together. I have several people who said to me, you know, every time that I write a new novel, I buy a new copy and then I mark it all up while I'm writing. and basically, you know, that's my outline for my book by the time I'm done.
You've got a couple of other books on writing too. Tell me about those.
Well, I've got one called Writing Wonder. Yeah. And when we start talking about the important emotional draws that we have, you know, we talk about romance or you can talk about horror, or you can talk about, adventure for thriller writers. Well, one of those is wonder. And we don't have a genre called wonder, but we do have all of the others. And the reason we don't have a genre called wonder is because half of it is science fiction. A third of it is called children's literature, young adult, middle grade, you know, those kinds of things. And so we've taken one genre and cut it up into four different pieces, which is unfair because in reality, it's actually the largest genre out there in most years, the best-selling genre. If you take young adult sales, grade sales, and you put those with science mm-hmm. fiction and fantasy, it turns into the largest genre.
That's a good point. And at least one other.
I've got other books on writing. I told Brandon Mole, who's a middle grade writer, a little bit about how you could become a best-selling author. And he said, you know, I think I'm going to go give that a try. And so he wrote the book Fable Haven. He came in with a contract the very next day. And anyway, he went out and I told him that I thought you could use this method to hit number. You could hit up on the top five on the New York Times bestseller list within three books. He hit number one on his third book and got his first multi-million dollar contract on book four.
Wow.
And so that's kind of the goal. So $1 million book signings, which is another one that I did, really teaches you how to do book signings. I set the Guinness record for the world's largest book signing.
I read that. California. Tell me, how'd that happen?
You know, it's just a publicity stunt.
It's it's a pretty good one.
Yeah.
You know, well attended.
You get it well attended. I mean, we had movie stars and we had some TV celebrities and we had some rock bands playing and, you know, that kind of thing. And then you throw in a book signing and everybody comes in and buys the book.
You know? You're saying they were really there to see the Rolling Stones, but you were there with books? Or
that was pretty much it. Yeah.
I doubt that somehow. Oh, that's incredible. All right. I promised we'd talk about your books eventually. So let's get to that. I'm so impressed. You know, I love to read. I love to watch fantasy sometimes. But I've written a bunch of books, but I've never written in that genre. And frankly, I don't think it would be a good thing for me to attempt. But you seem to go there naturally and people love what you do. How do you make that magic happen?
You know, I think that I just fell in love with the genre when I was a teenager, and it's interesting to me because you know, I've been a prison guard and, you know, from a police family, and my grandpa was in the mafia and all of this stuff. You'd think I'd be writing thrillers or something,
or perhaps a family biography
or a family biography. Yeah, but fantasy has always fascinated me. And you know, you look back in history, and you can go back to Homer, and Shakespeare was a fantasist too. And you look at it and you go, yeah, it's not only a very respected genre and a long-lived one, but it's just has always been my favorite. So I'm always experiencing a sense of wonder, you know, even as a pre-med student. You know, I went there because I was always kind of in awe of what's going on in the human body. And so loving all things science and all things nerdy, it somehow just fit.
I know the Rune Lords, number one New York Times best-selling series, right? Mm-hmm. Where'd that idea come from?
You know, I had been thinking for a long time about what would make a really cool magic system. Mm-hmm. And I pondered this question for about a year. And I was actually just in Scotland one day, and we were driving past a lock, and all of a sudden, the idea just started pouring into me. I can't explain it. You know, it was, it's when you are pondering something deeply for a long time, I believe that what happens is that the right portion of your brain starts thinking about it subconsciously. Mm-hmm. And when it comes up with the answer, it just reveals it to you. And, Einstein was sitting on the toilet pondering math problems when he thought of the theory of relativity. Okay. And it's the same way with all of us, you know. Watson and Crick were Watson was in an elevator, I believe it was, you know, and started thinking about what do those old stairs go that were winding up there. And that's when he, you know, thought of the double helix structure of DNA, you know, and he's like, wait a minute, that's how genes work. Okay,
wow.
Cool. And so the same thing happens with us. Mm. I just knew I wanted a magic system that dealt with what I call economics, you know, people making trades and what is the right way for people to conduct themselves, you know, morally in a situation like that. And so there were a lot of parameters that I'd set on it.
Okay, there's a burning question in the writing world today, and you've probably heard this before, pantser or planner?
I've done both.
Yeah.
And I've tried both. And, you know, being a pantser is a little bit more exciting because you don't know exactly where you're going.
Right.
And it's also more dangerous because you're more likely to steer yourself into a dead end.
Right.
So I tend to plot after, you know, writing $1 million outlines kind of gives me away. but I don't plot the entire novel. What I do is I plot my first third of my novel. So I kind of like to know where I'm going. I write that first third, and then I stop and I plot the next third, and then I plot the next third. And the reason why is that most authors when they plot out a novel, and let's say they've got an entire novel, they plot it out, they get about halfway and they abandon their original plot anyway. They realize that they have made so many little changes
right.
that the book has to be replotted. And I remember one author, I was at a panel with some other New York Times bestsellers, and he said, yeah, I just realized that if I plan on getting stuck halfway through, I'll be able to get to it faster, and I can go ahead and write that whole thing. And that just worked out really well. I thought, yeah, why plot a whole novel? Why not just plot it in thirds?
That's interesting. I don't think I've ever heard that particular system.
No, I'm the only person
before.
Crazy enough to try it.
Is that what it is? So you said you work all the time. You called yourself a workaholic. What does your day look like? I mean, morning person or evening or both? Or?
I'm more of a morning person. Yeah. I usually get up at 5 in the morning and I go to work. I like to try to get as much done by 1 or 2 in the afternoon as a normal person would do in a daytime. Then I go ahead and keep on working until usually about 9 o'clock. And that, point, I like to go to the gym and work out.
PM, 9 p.m. are we saying?
Yeah.
Holy smokes.
And then I like to go work out usually for an hour or so, lift weights and do some jogging and that kind of thing.
But when do you binge watch Netflix? And
I kind of gave that up.
Clearly.
It's funny. I'm a video game designer, and yet I don't play video games hardly ever anymore, you know.
Is that work? I mean, do you feel like you know enough about the games you're not playing to write them?
I don't know. My first game that I did was called StarCraft Brood War. And
great game. Huh? Just want everyone to know, great game. Anyway.
Yeah. And that one took off and went ballistic. I've never actually played it. Okay.
But you scripted it.
But I was the co-leader of the design team. So uh-huh. I worked on some of the creatures. If you've played it, you know what the Zerg Lurkers are. Those were mine. They're based on my Reavers from my Rune Lords novels, you know. So it was a matter of trying to create a game that had a great balance. And it's still used in the final rounds of the World Championship for video game players in mm-hmm. Korea and China and stuff like that. So it's
that's super cool.
So it's kind of fun.
No doubt. All right. So you've been at this writing thing for a while. Mm-hmm. I'm going to guess, I was talking about this earlier today at the conference, but there's some lessons that you've learned along the way. I mean, things you didn't know on book one that you discovered along the way that are important. Well, share some of those.
I think that each novel is different. I don't like to do cookie cutter novels. Mm-hmm. I don't want to feel like I'm writing the same book over and over. So each time that I start a novel, the most important part for me is to come up with a character with some conflicts that are really engaging for me and then let it go where it will and say, okay, how can I turn this into the most powerful book that I can? I think one of the lessons that I learned long ago was that when you write a book, one of my goals is to have the most powerful ending that I can come up with. Mm. And, you know, if you write a powerful ending, people will remember your name so that they can buy your next book. And that's an important thing to do. And so when I start looking at the ending of my novels, I don't look for an ending anymore. I look for the endings because each protagonist, each character that my readers have learned to care about has their own ending. And so, for example, I wrote a book called In the Company of Angels that, I had 180 characters in there who played minor parts. And as I started finishing up the novel, I realized I had to deal with a lot of these characters. You know, I had to deal with 35 or 40 of them and write about what actually did happen historically to them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, why they ended up being fascinating. And some of the stuff was so good as far as, you know, the historical things that really did happen that I couldn't have made it up. You know, if you make it up, it sounds unbelievable, but in real life, it really happens. And so the point of that was that, you know, I got it so that I had my readers crying for the last 250 pages. And you know, if you can keep them crying for 50 pages, you're doing fantastic. If you can keep them crying for 100 pages, you know, you're monumental. So that's what you're after is to create that powerful emotion as much as you possibly can.
That's fantastic. All right. One last question. what should we be looking for from you next? What's next from David Farland?
Well, I'm working on my final book in the Rune Lords series. Ninth book is called The Tale of Tales. And I'm just excited to be doing that right now. I'm also working on a book that's a historical novel called, it's set in Fiji. And I tentatively working title is called Love Among the Cannibals.
It's a romance,
it's
I guess.
It's a romance. Yes. It is. It's a romance set in Fiji. It's about the first, one of the first white men who went to Fiji back in the 1800s.
Wow.
And it's a true story. And once again, I couldn't make it up because you wouldn't believe it.
Okay, when that comes out, will you come back on the podcast?
Sure, be happy to.
All right, David, thank you so much. All right, sneakers, please rate or review this show wherever you get podcasts. It really does help us get the word out and help other people find the podcasts and everything else that we're doing. You can follow the podcast so that, you know, it's automatically downloaded for you each time we load a new episode. And if you click like on the video version or you subscribe to the William Bernhardt channel on YouTube, you'll be alerted every time we're live streaming a new episode. So until next time, keep writing. And remember, you cannot fail if you refuse to quit. And next year, join us at WriterCon. We're having a great experience, right? Yeah.